Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we're looking at an exciting new film, One Night in Miami. Season 6 of this podcast has been all about 2020 films, some streaming gems and other award season favorites. The interesting thing about this year is that some of those movies fall into both of those camps. That is, they're expected to win big this award season, and they're easily available to stream. That's the case with today's film, which hit theaters on Christmas Day, but will be streaming just a couple weeks later on Amazon Prime on January 15th. You may be familiar with Regina King from her acting. She won an Oscar for her part in If Beale Street Could Talk, and she recently starred in the incredible Watchmen series on HBO. This film, One Night in Miami, marks her first time behind the camera for a feature, and she came out swinging, pun intended there, because this film focuses on legendary boxer Cassius Clay, as well as the other prominent historical figures Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, and Malcolm X. When Cassius Clay unexpectedly won the title of heavyweight champion of the world on a night in February 1964, he hung out afterwards with those three people. And this film imagines what that night might have been like. Screenwriter Kemp Powers is a lover of history and wrote this screenplay with a sense of respect for each of its subjects. I'm joined again by film podcaster and programmer of the Arkansas Times film series, Omaya Jones. If you're not familiar with Omaya, he's appeared on this podcast many times and is just amazingly knowledgeable and insightful about movies. So it's always a treat when he can come by. Welcome back to the podcast, Omaya Jones. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm staying sane in quarantine. Are you?
As best as possible. In quarantine, it's just been a weird period because I never really stopped working. I can do a lot of work over the phone. I also have an opportunity to go outside at least once a day because I have to walk my dogs and things like that. So I haven't experienced the same claustrophobia I think that a lot of people have.
Yeah, I think that too. I'm kind of a homebody anyway. So like, there's a part of me, like obviously I wish I could go to movie theaters and, you know, not have to wear a mask when I go places. But there is a part of me that's like, more home time? All right, sounds good. But also I have children and it's exhausting because we're homeschooling now, which I love and I'm enjoying. But I'm getting lots of good family time. But also I don't have as much me time as I used to, but that's okay. Anyways, I was going to ask you, what have you been watching lately?
Yeah, so lately I've been watching a bunch of different stuff. There was a period of time when I kind of got away from watching things as much as I had been earlier in quarantine.
Yeah.
But the past couple of weeks, I have dived into Steve McQueen's Small Axe series that's been on Amazon, and I've seen three of those.
Nice.
And everyone, like all the hype around Lovers Rock is real. Everyone should watch that immediately. They're all worth watching. Some of them are fictional. Some of them are historical. So it's just like a really fascinating series of things. Last night I watched, or to back up, like this week I've watched three things. Last night I watched The African Queen, which I think might have been Bogart's last movie, not one of his last films. And then two of the movies that I've watched this week were both Sound of Metal. So nice. I watched it Monday and then I watched it again last night.
Nice.
So
that's at the top of my list to watch probably next. I'm going to maybe tonight or tomorrow try to watch that.
It's highly recommended. I want people, it's streaming on Amazon Prime, and I had seen some hype around it and I didn't know anything about it going in except that if you look at the cover image, it's a guy, a shirtless guy playing drums. And so I knew, so metal was like a reference to the music or something, but it's so much more than that. But I want people to kind of go in cold because I think that's the best way. That lead actor Riz Ahmed was on Fresh Air this week. So after you see it, that's an interview you can check out. He's also been in a bunch of other stuff. Like he's been in Girls. He was in.
Yeah, I knew his name. I recognize his name for sure. I'm going to pull up. Go ahead though.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else he's in, but he's been around for a while. It kind of reminds me of, like, I hope he kind of breaks out, and it kind of reminds me of, if you remember way back when the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern came out. I don't know if you saw that or not, but one of the actors in that you may or may not recognize was Taika Waititi, and it was before he had kind of broken out. Yeah. So, Riz Ahmed, he was in Venom, Rogue One.
Oh yeah, he's in Rogue One, and then I recognize him from Nightcrawler.
Oh yeah, he's also in The Sisters Brothers, which I watched in the past month or so.
Nice, I haven't watched that one yet.
So,
but that's been one that's been on my list. Yeah. Well, what I've been watching lately, I was going to mention Small Axe. I've only watched Mangrove, the first one, but I really loved it, and looking forward to diving into the rest of it. I think it would make for kind of a long podcast episode, but maybe you should come back and talk about Small Axe in a few weeks if you're up for that. But I can recommend Mangrove. That's as far as I've gotten in it. I've watched a handful of things. I watched Eyes Wide Shut for the first time. I'd never seen that.
Ooh.
And I'm in a little Zoom movie club, and that's what they are doing this week, since it's sort of a Christmas adjacent movie. And yeah, I really liked it. I'm still kind of processing it, but I knew a lot of the kind of the crazy stuff that was in it. So I was able to kind of more focus on, I don't know, the character and like, I don't know, the kind of what it's saying about marriage or what questions it's asking about marriage, I think is interesting. So I'm still working on that. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. I watched the new Steven Soderbergh, Let Them All Talk, which I thought was really like a lovely little movie. It's kind of, yeah, small, but it's got really great performances from Meryl Streep and Candice Bergen and I'm trying to think of the other actor. I'm blanking on her name right now. But it's kind of three older women. And then it's got Lucas Hedges in it as well. And yeah, I thought they're all well acted and just a really, really well done script and everything. So I'll recommend that. That's on HBO. I'll mention a couple other things. I rewatched The Favorite from a few years ago, the Yorgos Lanthimos. And that one really held up for me. I saw it in the theater and I hadn't seen it since then. And yeah, it's really good. Great performances. Again, great script. His directorial decisions are really interesting. So anyway, I'll re-recommend that if anyone hasn't seen that. And then I'm still watching through Bergman stuff. I have the Bergman set now, which is exciting, so I can watch all of it. But I'm trying to kind of watch through the major ones and then go back and watch everything. So my next one up was Cries and Whispers, which completely blew me away. So amazing. Yeah, so I'll recommend that as well. You have any thoughts on any of those? That's a lot. It's been, we haven't done a segment like this in a few weeks, so that's a few weeks worth of stuff for me.
Yeah. So the Eyes Wide Shut is the only Kubrick I haven't seen.
Ah.
And so just now I just made the decision that I'm going to rectify that on Christmas Day. I've decided.
There you go. Yeah.
So, and of course, Tom Cruise is in the news for yelling at yelling at some people on set, and it completely justified, you know.
Yeah,
it's the only one of the few times there's been a tirade by an actor where the majority of the reaction is positive or in their defense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, like I haven't seen a lot of people criticizing Tom Cruise for going off on crew people for violating protective COVID protocols.
Yeah, it's different than like the Christian Bale thing a few years ago where he just like freaks out at the light guy for no reason. Yeah, this was a little more justified. I think it was Variety or something had the headline was, "Be honest, you kind of agree with Tom Cruise about this," or something like that.
Yeah. I haven't seen the new Soderbergh yet. I'm interested in that. I watched the last one he did. I think it was the last one. He does so many things so quickly.
Yeah, I haven't seen the last few. But when I saw Meryl's face on it, I was like, yeah, I should watch that.
There was a profile or something on him where I think they were talking about the process of editing Unsane. And so, you know, he famously shoots things with iPhones with
yeah.
all these different filters and technology and things. And he also edits on the go. So like as they're shooting, they're editing. And there was a story where they're at like the rap party. I think it was for Unsane. And after a few hours or a couple hours into the rap party, he says like, "Do you guys want to watch a rough cut?" And he just like cut, you know, just finished the film just right there.
That's wild.
And yeah, it's like a real DIY thing. And he also, I know like with the Nick, he shot a lot of that himself too. And we don't have to go into it. It's just weird.
Did he do Let Them All Talk on an iPhone? I'm looking to find out if he did.
I don't know. But it's funny. If you watch High Flying Bird, there's a shot where even if you went in not knowing that it was shot on an iPhone, If you're just thinking about the way the shot works, you realize like something's going on because the phone or the camera is on a table, and it's just a shot that you could not get with a conventional camera.
Huh, interesting. Wow. Well, there you go. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Have you seen Cries and Whispers?
I have not.
It's good. I recommend that one for sure. I think it's Bergman's first one in color, which was interesting, and it's got a lot of bright colors, and I have the Criterion disc, so I watched all the special features and stuff, and it's interesting stuff. So yes, that kind of went quickly to the top of my favorite Bergman movies. But all right, well, without further ado, then let's get into One Night in Miami.
You brothers, you could move mountains without lifting a finger.
Minister Malcolm X.
Good news, the chariot is coming.
Who's the greatest?
You are!
That's right.
Jim Brown takes the ball.
Your record is going to stand the test of time.
All together, yeah.
The entire city of Miami is celebrating.
I'm the new heavyweight champion of the world, and I don't even have a scratch on my face.
Oh, my goodness.
What's on, Cass?
Why am I so pretty?
Hey, congratulations, champ.
I can get used to that.
I was made in America, land of the free, home of the brave.
This movement that we are in is called a struggle. Because we are fighting for our lives.
Welcome to America.
This ain't about civil rights.
Welcome to America.
They ain't giving black people what they really want.
What's that?
I was made in America. That's why I'm out here saving America.
Power.
Black power.
I like the sound of that.
I wish I lived in America.
We have to be there for each other.
Heard everybody rich. All I gotta do is run, jump, kick. I'm a kid in your area. I done made it to America. I'm amazed at America. Welcome to America.
All right, let's talk about One Night in Miami. So this is set in 1964. It tells the story of four men who are also celebrities, who have become pretty hugely significant in just in American history. That's Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Jim Brown, and Sam Cooke. They really did celebrate together after Cassius Clay's huge unexpected boxing victory in 1964, in which he became the heavyweight champion of the world. And so this film follows these four men as they just their conversations, what they're doing as they're spending time together. And this is directed by Regina King. It's her directorial debut, and it was written by Kemp Powers, who's a playwright before this. And so he imagined what they might have talked about on this night and created this fascinating dialogue-heavy drama. So that's kind of the setup of this. I want to talk first about just Regina King. I think it's interesting that this is her first movie. She's obviously such a great actor, won an Oscar for If Beale Street Could Talk a few years back, and recently was in Watchmen that we discussed, Omaya. I think she is obviously a tremendous actress, and I think she does a great job here as well. What is your impression of her directing skills here?
Yeah, I think she does a phenomenal job. I was reading an interview, and she talks about how one of the reasons she chose this script in particular was that since it's all on the page in terms of like the character, the voice, she could really focus on the visuals. Mm, yeah. And I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because we saw this, I think, in October.
Yes, we watched this at the drive-in at the same time. So it's been a few months, but yeah.
But I know like there's like a shot where during the title bout, there's like an overhead shot of the ring, that's where they're fighting. Mm. And she does a lot. It's weird because, you know, it's adapted from a play. And so one of the things that always comes up when you're adapting something from a play is how do you make it cinematic?
Yeah.
And at some point I realized what people mean by that is like changing locations. Mm-hmm. So like another example of a play that was adapted to a film was like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Mm-hmm. And you can do a lot just to make it the film feel bigger than it is when you're sort of opening it up from a play. And she does a really good job of that, just like staging to have them go from the interior of the hotel room out to like the rooftop to the parking lot, and, you know, just getting characters moving around in really interesting ways. And yeah, it's hard to talk about visually because it's been so long.
Yeah, I agree. This is one I definitely wish I had been able to revisit. It's going to be streaming before too long, but yeah, but I agree. I think, you know, as far as like making a stage play feel cinematic, I do think she does a great job. I remember the first time I had a sense of that in a movie was the movie Doubt with Meryl Streep, again, Meryl Streep, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, which I really like that movie, but I did have a sense like this feels kind of stagey, something about the way the dialogue worked, and there's not a ton of locations. It just, I was like, there could have been maybe more done here. You know, I want to criticize doubt, but I think here someone might watch this and have no idea that it was based on a stage play, because I think there is enough variation there. There is obviously a lot in one location in that hotel room. And actually, so I found as I was just researching Kent Powers, there is a short YouTube clip you can see of the stage production with all different actors. But the set is interesting because it's in the hotel room, and yet above them, like around the edges of the stage, there's like a second floor motel, like outdoors of a motel with all the doors, and like almost like it's looking down into the room, which is interesting. But I can imagine they use that creatively on the stage. But so that was an interesting thing, and maybe that can kind of transition into Kent Powers, because he wrote this, and at the screening, the Arkansas Cinema Society screening you and I got to go to, there was a Q&A with him afterwards, just like a Zoom recording, but it was really interesting. And he talked about just kind of being a history nerd and having feeling a connection to each of these four people, and then kind of one day happening across something that he was reading that they actually, these four were together that night. And he, like, there was a mind blowing revelation for him. And he kind of felt inspired to then kind of imagine what that would be like. He also mentioned, speaking of Regina King again, that he assumed that, Regina King would have someone else, you know, kind of adapt it for the screen and take it away from him, basically. And he was okay with that. But then she just kind of was like, no, I want you to do it. And he thought that he was kind of surprised by that, but impressed. So I thought that makes sense too. And he's been getting other work since then. He's been writing for the latest Star Trek show is, Discovery. I think he's written some episodes there. And then for the upcoming Pixar movie, Soul, he's one of the screenwriters there. So anyway, he seems to be getting a film career started really well with this movie. What's your impression of the script?
Yeah, I think the play is interesting in that it is this historical fiction, but the voice of the characters comes through. And I think a lot of that is because a lot of the dialogue is sort of taken from things that they said in other places, or sort of like the gist of things they said in other places. And so you get to see this conversation, this argument that was happening within the Black community play out within these four different perspectives. And I was sort of just like, so sort of taken with the idea that, like, oh, the idea for this play came from a paragraph in a book. Mm-hmm. I went out and I got the book. It's Redemption Song. Mm-hmm. Redemption Song, Muhammad Ali in the Spirit of the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it's chapter one, second paragraph, which picks up after the fight with Sonny Liston. After the fight, Clay chose to forego the usual festivities at one of Miami's luxury hotels and headed instead for the Black Ghetto, where he had made camp during training. He spent a quiet evening in private conversation with Malcolm X, the singer Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown, the great Cleveland Browns running back and an early champion of Black rights in sports. The next morning, after breakfast with Malcolm, Clay met with the press to confirm the rumors that he was involved with the Nation of Islam. And so, like, the whole play is sort of inspired by that single paragraph. It's the whole thing, but it's, you know, the book is really about, I think, the context of the times and everything that sort of led up to that, and then everything that how it all played out in the 60s after the fact. And it kind of goes into, well, after that, immediately, like, it jumps back to like 1908 and like Joe Louis, and yeah, it does a lot of things with the history, but it sort of like just gives the context of the times that led up to the 1960s and that revolutionary period.
Yeah, no, I agree. So for me, I think this was just really like educational, really enlightening. I think that the American school system doesn't do enough to teach Black history. And so a lot of this was like new information for me. Like, yeah, I was aware of who Cassius Clay and Malcolm X were. And Sam Cooke, but actually Jim Brown, I probably couldn't have told you, you know, before watching this, who that was, or having looked it up. But for me, this was a good like a primer for these four people, and yeah, like a jumping off point to want to research more about them. Like, I'm immediately after watching this, I got on Wikipedia and was like reading all about all of them. Like, wow, I never knew all this stuff. So I just knew, like, Muhammad Ali is, you know, the greatest boxer of all time, and I knew a bit about Malcolm X, but I certainly didn't know anything about their characters, and that's exactly what this movie tries to depict, is like, who are these people, and kind of Yeah, and then, again, imagining kind of how did they possibly interact, and yeah, well, it, as you're saying, brings in so much context about the past and looking kind of towards the future too. And it feels, and this is like an overused word, but it feels so timely, like mm-hmm. to just the conversation, the national conversation that has grown and grown even this year about race relations and stuff. So yeah, I really, really like this movie a lot. I think well acted across the board. And then one other thing I wanted to mention too about Kim Powers was that he said something about he misses when movies could just be about people talking. And that's mm-hmm. kind of what this movie is. And I thought that was a nice little quote from him about there is a plot to this movie, but it's kind of slender and it's mostly just fleshed out in the things they're saying and the performances. And with that in mind, I thought we might just kind of talk through each of the four characters and performances and the actors who play them, and kind of break down and even like what their viewpoint is in the movie and kind of how that plays out. Cause I think it's a really interesting, that's what this movie is mostly, is the meat of what they're talking about. So first up, sure. I thought we might talk about Cassius Clay. So this is right before he changed his name to Muhammad Ali as he joins the Nation of Islam. But we meet him at the beginning, and I think it's interesting. It kind of depicts him as he's very young, and he's like he's really funny and charming. And he's almost portrayed a little bit as like impressionable. But he's played by Eli Gorey, who... he was also part of the Q&A, and this is super interesting, is that he has been obsessed with Muhammad Ali for a long time, this actor, Eli Gorey, and he actually prepared to play him in something else and didn't get the part. I can't remember all the details there, but he had always been told that he bore a resemblance to him. And as an actor, he thought, you know, one day I'll play Cassius Clay in something, and put a lot of effort into learning that and developing that. Then didn't get that part, but said to himself, you know, I can still use this. Something else will come up, and this is what came up. So I thought that was a cool kind of full circle story. And he's so great in this. I think most of the funny moments come from him. Probably he's sort of the comedic relief. But yeah, so he is kind of getting. There's some almost a battle over his soul or something, as Malcolm X is wanting him to convert to Islam, and some of the other characters are telling him, you don't need to do that, that's not worth your time. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. What did you think about his character?
I thought he did a really good job with sort of the cadence and sort of trying mm-hmm. to do the voice without it being just like an impersonation.
Yeah.
And like you said, he was preparing for the role. He was trying to get the role of Malcolm X in a movie that was supposed to be directed by Ang Lee that I guess never got made. And when he didn't get the part, he just knew that he would have an opportunity to do it someday. So yeah, he kept working on it. And I think that seemed like that never happens.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like
it's wild.
And, you know, I haven't seen Michael Mann's Ali film. I don't know how he compares to Will Smith, but I thought that it was like very convincing to me.
Yeah.
And Muhammad Ali is an interesting figure. Or I guess I don't know if I should call him Cassius Clay, because in the film he's not Muhammad Ali yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting in that he's doing this thing where the way the film portrays it, Malcolm X is courting him to join the Nation of Islam, but I think he'd already been associated with the Nation for a couple of years at this point, but not publicly. So nobody
right.
knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, are you going to come out publicly declare? And then Malcolm X also knows that there's this growing schism between himself and the Nation, and what side will Ali be on if that happens? Mm. But Ali doesn't want necessarily to be this publicly political figure.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that in the, like in the sound clip or in the press conference that happens the next day, where he does come out publicly as a member of the Nation of Islam, he says some things that are kind of reminiscent to me of like Charles Barkley in the 90s saying, you know, I'm not a role model. Mm-hmm. But he's like this fiercely independent figure who just wants to do things his way and be like not necessarily a part of this thing. And what's interesting is that Muhammad Ali becomes, regardless of whether or not he wants to be this political figure, he kind of gets dragged into it throughout the decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that ends up being kind of the central conflict is between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke, kind of about that kind of thing. It's like, what is the role of a black man in society, a prominent black man in society, to you know, be outspokenly fighting against racial things. And so he's sort of caught in the middle there. And I think you're right, it shows him before the fight. So at the very beginning of this is before the fight. And then we don't actually see the fight. We do see a short amount of the fight. That's right. You mentioned the shot overhead. But then the vast majority is the night after. But before the fight, they go and pray together. And he says something about, I need my insurance policy or something like that. I got to make sure I pray before the fight. And it gives some time to like showing the way the prayer works, and he doesn't get all the steps right, and Malcolm X has to kind of guide him and correct him a little bit. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's like showing this really prominent person like at a very early point in their career. But let's talk about Jim Brown next. He again was the one that I think I'd heard his name, and it turns out I'd seen him in acting and things. But he's actually the only one of these four people who's still alive. But he was an NFL player and then became an actor. And so at this point in the movie, he's kind of on the cusp of that decision, where he talks about feeling controlled by the NFL and how he can make so much more more money in the movies. And I'd seen him in The Dirty Dozen was the big one that I remember seeing him in. But
have you seen Mars Attacks?
I've actually not seen Mars Attacks. No, it's always been one. Like, I should watch that someday. But I saw that he's in that on IMDb. But he's interesting. So it kind of opens with him going to visit someone in his hometown, an older white man, and you see like the complicated relationship there, that, you know, this guy's super nice to him, and he's like, oh, you're great at what you do, and is kind of like buttering him up. And then there's some little moment where it's like, oh, I can come inside and do something, and he's like, well, you know, we don't allow black people in our house. And it's just like he's like being very pleasant in his tone, but being obviously very blatantly racist. And it's just kind of showing, I think, the temperature of the time and how he must have experienced so much of that kind of thing. But so then it follows him, and I think he and Muhammad Ali have an interesting dynamic, because they are kind of famous in the same way, in a way, something like that. They're kind of younger, and they seem to have, they go off at one point to a liquor store or something like that, and the dynamic they have is a little bit more, it seems like the other two are like more quote unquote serious, and always want to talk about the kind of the bigger world things. But I had an interesting just feeling that those two had a funny connection there. But yeah, what do you think about Jim Brown?
So just from following football, I kind of know Jim Brown's history as the running back of the Cleveland Browns, and he, like a few other athletes like Barry Sanders or someone, retired really before they had to. For a lot of reasons, but yeah, if nothing else, just because football is it's a game that takes a physical toll on your body, and acting is a career that doesn't necessarily do that.
Yeah.
And he also would have more control. So he seems to me as a character, as he's like the odd man out in this.
Yeah.
And even like just flipping through the book, that, not that this is based on, but like he doesn't come up that often.
Yeah.
You know? But he has to, it's like he's in the play because he was there that night.
Yeah.
And the actor, Aldous Hodge, I think is interesting in that he, you know, he was also in The Invisible Man.
Oh yeah, that's right. But, that's where I've seen him most recently. Yeah. It's like the cop friend.
Yeah. As well as Die Hard with a Vengeance, which was his acting debut.
Yes. Amaya sent me a YouTube clip. I was like, guess how this is connected? And I was like, what are you talking about? And it's Aldous Hodge as a little kid in Die Hard 3. That's great.
Yeah, but he of the four, he's the one that seems the least conflicted and the most sure of what he wants from his life and from his career.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of like he studies Ali in that effort, I think.
Yeah, he's probably the voice, the most blatant voice that's like, why would you join the Nation of Islam? Like he's kind of the voice of dissent there for Ali. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, because like there's not, you know, from the other characters, they have moments where they sort of, well, especially from like Cook and Malcolm X, they have moments where they sort of articulate their vision very clearly. And I don't remember getting that from Jim Brown.
Yeah, he's the one I would, on a rewatch, would want to really key in to see, like, what's his main role here. But yeah, he's I think you're right in saying he's kind of the odd man out of the four. Talking about like the movie industry a little bit, you get a little bit of a glimpse into kind of his struggles and sort of maybe generally the struggles that black men were having, you know, with fame and kind of that dynamic a little bit. But yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's talk about Malcolm X next. He's played by Kingsley Benadire, who I haven't seen in much else, but he's in several other things. He played Barack Obama, actually, in that Showtime special, The Comey Rule, which I watched earlier this year. I think it's pretty good. And he's barely in it, but he's a pretty good Obama. But obviously, as Malcolm X, he's very outspoken, and he's the one who's courting Cassius Clay and is... The conflict with Sam Cooke about you should be doing more to be outspoken and fight against racism. This is like the struggle of our time. And if you're just benefiting from the systems that are there, then you're not doing enough and you're part of the problem. It's kind of his the general way to articulate where he's coming from. But yeah, so that conflict is much of the conflict of this movie and leads to some really interesting conversations. And so just those kind of dueling worldviews. And so we can talk about Sam Cooke's half of that in a minute. But what do you think about Kingsley Benadire's performance here?
I think he's a good Malcolm X. I think it probably took me a minute to adjust because in my head I was probably thinking of Denzel Washington. And that's a tough thing when you have such an iconic portrayal of an actual person. And then someone else comes along and they're sort of battling against that. But he does, I think, a good job sort of portraying like the conflicted nature of Malcolm X, right? Because Spike Lee's film sort of is like cradle to grave, the entire life of Malcolm X. And this is like pretty much like one section of like the last portion of that movie and really getting to like dive into where he was at this time and sort of trying to like separate himself from the Nation of Islam, knowing that there are ramifications for that, fearing for his life. This film doesn't go to the point to where we see what happens, how everything plays out, but it takes place on like February 25th, 1964, and Malcolm X was assassinated February 21st, 1965.
Yeah, so it's about a year,
like almost exactly a year to the day, a year before this is when this movie takes place. And so it, like, if you know that, if you just know the history going in, and that's kind of like with all these characters, if you know some of the history going in, there are parts of it that are sort of like feel kind of ominous, which will come up when we talk about Sam Cooke.
Yes.
But yeah, I think, like, you know, we see him, he's being accompanied by a couple of Nation of Islam bodyguards, one of them played by Lance Reddick, and who seems like very skeptical of Malcolm X and is not, he doesn't seem like he's there to protect him necessarily as much as he's there to keep an eye on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. And then there's the younger one too, who, they have a conversation with at one point, and that's an interesting, I actually wrote down some of the dialogue there. This is maybe not exactly right. Because I was, you know, at the drive-in trying to scribble this down, but, he asks, Cassius Clay, I think asks him, or maybe Jim Brown asks him if he likes being a Muslim. And he says, yeah, I regret not joining younger. And he talks about what he gets out of it. And he has, these people have my back all the time and I'm not alone. And then one of the characters, again, I can't remember who, I think maybe Jim Brown says, you don't need religion for that. You could just join a gang. And then someone else says, what's the damn difference? And so I thought that was an interesting perspective on just at least one person's experience with the Nation of Islam and kind of why he joined. But yeah, I think so Malcolm X, you're right, it has those moments where he's afraid someone's following him, and there's a moment where he calls home, and knowing that, I didn't know exactly how close to his death this took place before watching it, but I knew it was near the end of his life. So there's almost a sense of, you know, he wants to do as much as he can to convince these guys to kind of carry the torch, you know, if he's fearing for his life at this point. So I think that's an interesting level to it.
I don't know if you looked up when Sam Cooke died, but what do we get to Sam Cooke?
Yes. Well, let's talk about Sam Cooke. Yeah. So I did not know any of the controversy around his death, but he actually is the first of these four people who died. And for context, Muhammad Ali just died in 2016. Jim Brown is still alive, as we mentioned, and Malcolm X about a year after the events of this movie. And then Sam Cooke, just a few months, this from February to December, he was killed. And yeah, so that's an interesting point out too. But his character, I guess backing up, his character is really interesting. He's played by Leslie Odom Jr., who is, I just think he's phenomenal. I know him mostly from Hamilton as Aaron Burr, but he is so good here too. He gets to sing and kind of show off his vocal abilities. But then his kind of counterpoint to Malcolm X's perspective is that he wants to like beat the system in a way, like infiltrate the system that is there as a musician. That's the music industry for him. And so there's a lot of things about it. You know, Malcolm X is telling him, you should be more outspoken. You should be fighting more. You're just a part of, you just go to clubs and entertain white people. You're just like one of the good ones, quote unquote, in the eyes of white people. And you should be fighting because, you know, this is a big problem. And so he has a great speech where he talks about royalties, basically, and the Rolling Stones bought a song that he wrote. And so now he says, now when white people buy the song, they are giving black people money. And he's kind of being subversive in that way. And he's saying, I don't want a piece of the pie. I want the recipe. That's one of the quotes there. So that was pretty interesting. And I think he talks too about like, you know, I'm winning. I'm beating the system too. If I'm beating them at their own game, it kind of an idea. So yeah, I thought this was an interesting thing, and they argue a lot. Yeah, what did you notice that was ominous here? I'm curious.
So you know, it's the use of the song. A Change Is Going to Come, and one of the things that I like is how it plays with the chronology of events. You know, the way it's portrayed in the movie is that they're in this hotel room. Sam Cooke says, "You know what? I've been working on this song," and then he plays it for them. I recall that happening in the movie. And then like after that night in Miami, we see Sam Cooke on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, and he performs the song.
Yeah.
When it actually happened, or like the actual order of events is that he wrote and recorded the song in, I think, January of that year of 64. Okay. And performed it on February 7th.
Wow.
So, you know, it plays with the timeline a little bit.
Yeah, but it wasn't in a way that time.
It works really well. Mm-hmm. And it may have, as an event, I think among a lot of people, it may have been overshadowed by the fact that 2 days later, the Beatles performed on the Ed Sullivan Show. So
interesting.
But yeah, so he only performed the song live once. And I read this write-up that was on NPR for the 50th anniversary. And they talked to Bobby Womack, who was his, not disciple, but maybe protege is the right word. Mm. But they talked about how when he first played it for Bobby Womack, he asked Bobby what he thought about it. And he said, it sounds like death. And he said, that's how it kind of sounds to me. That's why I'm never going to play it in public. And then Bobby Womack thought about it. And he said, like, well, it's not like death. It just sounds kind of spooky. Huh. And it is, you know, it is, you know, and like even in Spike Lee's Malcolm X film, it's played on the soundtrack when Malcolm X is on his way to his last speech. Mm-hmm. So the song does have these overtones that make it sound kind of like ominous.
Yeah.
Right. And then of course Sam Cooke died in December of 1964. So
yeah,
less than a year later, he was killed in an incident that it sounds really sort of messy and complicated. I don't know if you've read into it.
I just read again the Wikipedia kind of article about it, but yeah, it's a very he said she said kind of thing, and black versus white in that context. And it's it seems really shady, basically.
Yeah I mean, it's strange because, well, we don't have to go into the details, but like, he was like killed by a hotel manager, essentially.
Yeah. Super random, seemingly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think like Leslie Odom Jr. is a phenomenal actor. It has been wonderful to see this, like the number of people whose careers are taken off post Hamilton.
Yeah.
There are always these things, like The Wire is another example of something that just spawns the careers of many people, you know, like, and it creates like this, there's like an alumna of people from The Wire, like graduated from The Wire to go on and do a bunch of other things. Hamilton is having a similar effect with a number of people who were in the original cast. And it's been really fun to see that happen.
Yeah, I agree. We love Hamilton in my house, and my wife listens to it almost every day. She loves it so much, and I love it too. But yeah, hearing he's probably my favorite. I mean, that's a big statement because everyone in Hamilton is so great. But his performance, his songs are among my favorite songs. But yeah, I love seeing that Daveed Diggs is doing so much. Have you seen Blindspotting, by the way, with Daveed Diggs?
I have. That was Blindspotting was one of the things that I've seen since quarantine that I missed in theaters. And I think it is a really fun movie in the way it plays around with different perspectives and things.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, I really like it. And they're making a TV show, kind of a spinoff show out of it. So I saw him on Instagram about something that they're working on that right now. So anyway, I'll recommend Blindspotting. But yes, back to Sam Cooke. But yeah, there's a couple great scenes where he, there's a flashback scene once to a concert that I think Malcolm X was there watching it. Or one of them was there. Yes, Malcolm X. And basically the sound equipment went out and he kept the show going with no microphone. And it shows that it's kind of a powerful moment. And Malcolm X is really thinks so highly of him. That's what's so interesting, I think, about it is like he disagrees fundamentally with the way Sam Cooke handles racial issues, but he thinks really highly of him as a person and as a figure. And he says a few times something like your voice is so powerful. If you would just use it differently, it could be huge. And so I think that's a really interesting part of that.
Yeah. Well, I would just say like that scene that you reference is a good example of how you can take something like a play and make it really cinematic. Mm-hmm. And it's also, if you watched Lover's Rock, is really reminiscent of something that Steve McQueen does in that film.
I haven't watched it yet, but very soon I'm going to, but so I'll be watching for that. But another musical thing that's really interesting is I think this is also Malcolm X. Like, I hate that I'm keep saying I think it was this, but it's been a few months. But who talks about the Bob Dylan song Blowing in the Wind, and he listens to it, like they play it on the radio, I think, and he says something like he kind of talks through some of the lyrics at the beginning of it. And he's like, he's talking about the black experience in a way. But this is some white guy on the radio. And I listened to that song as I was kind of preparing for this, and then found out Sam Cooke has a cover version on one of his albums that's streaming. You can go listen to it. And so I thought that was a cool way that maybe Kent Powers is almost saying like, you know, possibly here's a fun theory of how, the scene could have been planted for Sam Cooke to want to perform this song. Because the Sam Cooke version obviously sounds very different than the Bob Dylan version, but it's pretty cool. That's Blowing in the Wind.
Yeah, no, and that apparently really happened. Like, really? Sam Cooke really did. It's referenced in the book.
Okay.
How Sam Cooke was taken with that song and really thought, like, I should have written that, or like one of us should have written that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so Malcolm has some line about, this is about the oppressed having to work harder to be recognized. And so that's kind of the core idea in the song that really resonates with the experience he's having as a black man. Speaking of Sam Cooke and musical performances, his opening scene. So this is another example of Regina King's, I think, strong direction. He's playing at the Copacabana, actually. It's kind of cool. It's like a famous club. And he is playing to an all-white audience, which apparently was not uncommon for him. And there's a shot, though, when he's on stage where just the camera angle makes him look really tiny in the frame, and this white crowd is huge in the frame, and it just feels really intimidating. And so I thought that was a cool way to kind of set up his character, that he's fearless in a way, that he's not afraid to go do this, and he sees a strength in that, and that comes out later in the discussion with everyone. So I thought that was another nice directorial touch.
Yes. There are a number of scenes before the film starts properly that sets up, I don't know if they're in the play or not, but they kind of open up the film. So we get like little vignettes of each of the four main characters. Yeah. And I'm trying to like the Jim Brown one just like makes an impression. You know, you can't forget that. Yeah. And like, just like the way, the disappointment in that. I think the Muhammad Ali one, I think he like loses a fight.
For Malcolm X, it shows his wife is watching him on TV and then he comes home. Mm-hmm. One thing that Sam Cooke says about his kind of the conflict that he and Malcolm X are having, there's a little bit of a conversation between them. He says, don't you think that me commanding my own business destiny is better than just making people mad? Or it's something along those lines. And then Malcolm X says back to him something about he's too bougie. He says, you bougie people don't understand what's really at stake. Or I think he says bourgeois. He wouldn't have said bougie at that time. He says, you bourgeois people don't understand what's really at stake. That kind of nicely encapsulated the heart of their conflict. Yeah, just really well written. You can kind of tell like Kent Powers has a knack for dialogue as a screenwriter. Obviously, like that's a lot of what, I mean, as a playwright. But I think that really comes through. Like that really is the strongest thing about this, is the dialogue is really, really well done.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a play overall, I just think it's a phenomenally well piece of written work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I just think it's how much of the dialogue and the debate and the discussions seem to have come just directly from the people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so like with Bob Dylan, I'm not going to read the whole paragraph because it's quite long, but you know, it talks about Blowin' in the Wind and how it was covered by a number of different people, including Sam Cooke. And then it says, Cooke remarked to friends that it was an embarrassment for black performers that it had been a white boy who first dared talk about race and politics and popular music. In January 1964, he wrote and recorded A Change Is Gonna Come, perhaps the first masterpiece of socially conscious soul. Yeah, so like that conflict, as it's depicted in the film, came right from, you know, the actual history.
Yeah.
You know, that's not just supposition. That it actually happened that way. And I think one of the things that I like about this film and the various discussions is that it shows how a lot of the conversations that we're having today, this is not the first time they've had them. They were doing this in the 60s. And of course, in the 60s, it was coming after things that happened in the 50s and before that, the 30s and the 20s and so on and so forth, you know, for all of time. And a lot of times when I hear or read activists and people today talk, there's like a recency bias. It's not just activists, it's people in general, I think, have this recency bias where they act as though history started either when they were born or when they became politically aware.
Yeah.
And what I like about this film is that it's this opportunity for people to sit back and think like, okay, it's the same struggle.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
There are areas in which we've made progress. There are areas in which we've gone backwards, but we're still, it's the same struggle as it's always been.
Mm.
And, you know, it's always been a tumultuous time and that hasn't changed.
Yeah, absolutely. It totally has resonance today. And I think that's one of the just powerful things about either watching older films. I've talked about like watching classic films and why I love it is because it does give that picture of a time period, or watching films that accurately or with just time, the films that depict a previous time with an eye for you know, kind of the spirit of the time and what things were like politically and that kind of thing. It does. I think it can open eyes in a way that can be really powerful. Because, yeah, you're right. Like, I tend to think that things have only been the way they are for a short amount of time. But this just reminds me again, like, yes, this has been this way for a long time. And I think especially for younger generations who might be able to watch this and see, like, obviously this is really educational for me, but imagine like a high school student seeing this or that kind of thing, kind of, I find inspiring that film can make a difference in that way. And as to the way this was adapted from real stuff, as you're saying, like so much of it clearly came straight from their actual words. And I think that's the way to adapt history, I think, is, I don't know, ethically or something, is to be as close to the real thing as you can and then be forthcoming about, like, yeah, this is a fictionalized account, but here's what I did to try to be as close as possible, which stands in contrast to a lot of historically made movies, like, speaking of Green Book, that won the Oscar, that not only has, like, some people have a lot of issues with the racial discussions in that movie and the way racism is depicted, and rightfully so. I agree with a lot of that, but also that the enormous liberties it takes with history. I've just done a little research around that, and like the family of the character in that is very unhappy with it because it paints him in a very different light than was reality for a story that was created to make white people feel better. Like it's just a whole big mess. But anyway, we don't have to talk about Green Book, but I think that's in such a contrast to this, which someone who, first of all, screenwriter of color, that probably makes a big difference, but has so much respect for the history of this and for the people involved and is staying so true to it. And yet then offering this artful, creative rendition of what this might have been. That's it's like it's clear that he doesn't expect anyone to believe this is exactly what happened, just in the way it's written. And anyway, I just have a lot of respect for Kent Powers, and I'm curious to see what he does next. I'm really anxious to watch Soul in a few weeks, as that's gonna stream soon. But anyway, yeah, I really, really like this movie.
Yeah, I hope everybody watches it. I think that one of the things that I noted, I think as I was watching it, I think I sent Michael Carpenter a text message, was just that you can get away with a lot in theater because it started as a play. And I think that there's more of a tradition in theater of openly playing with history,
right?
Probably. And like whether or not you're just talking about like different stagings of plays and things, like there's just more creativity, I think, in theater, I mean, when it comes to approaches to history,
like Hamilton, like which obviously is based on history, but again, it's like it knows no one in the audience thinks this is exactly how it really happened. Go on, though.
Right. Yeah. So, like, you know, if you made a movie, if Hamilton were a movie first, and people there would be a lot of writing like Thomas Jefferson was not black, you know, I think that would come up a lot.
It would be like a problem for people. Like,
yeah. People tend to be really literal with movies. And I think like, you know, you see it with like various websites and things that like movies, CinemaSins or something, where they're really nitpicky. And I think that, and part of it, I think it's just like the way that in theater, or at least with this play in particular, like there's a lot of talk about like, yeah, I made this up. And it's like very open and honest about that. You know, and like talking about the process and how they came to it. And maybe there's just like more of a history of that in theater than I think there is a lot of times in movies.
Well, that is One Night in Miami. That is streaming on Amazon Prime starting January 15th. Again, highly recommend everyone check it out. It's going to be, I can pretty much say it's going to be in my top 10 of 2020. The question is how high. I'm still working on that. I have a lot of things to still try to watch by the end of the year. But yes, very much recommend this. And it sounds like you do also, Omaya.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks again, Omaya, for coming back and discussing this with us. I'm sure you'll be back on the podcast very soon. But until then, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Art House Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. If you want to support Art House Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Art House Garage t-shirt, or actually we have some hats too. That's at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob-free.